You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Today's New York Times reports that an increasing number of states faced with chronic overcrowding of their prisons have been shipping some of their inmates out of state. In the 1920s, about 107 per 100,000 Americans were incarcerated. That began to rise in the late 70s and has since quadrupled. David Wyman of Columbia University founded the Russell Sage Foundation in 2000 in order to research this trend toward what some call mass incarceration and to determine what effect it's had on low-income urban communities. He and Michael Stoll of UCLA have edited a study on the subject called Barriers to Reentry, the Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America. It is published by Russell Sage Foundation. And I want to thank both Michael Stoll and David Wyman for agreeing to join me today on the show. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, what happened in the 1970s that led policymakers to change the way we incarcerate people in this country? Michael?
Oh, that's a good question for David to answer.
Okay.
He was the chief author of that chapter.
I should look and see who wrote what chapter.
Yes. Well, we identified two sets of factors that were relevant. One was actually a change in economic conditions, diminished demand for less skilled, less educated workers, which led to lower wages, increased unemployment. And those are strongly associated with increasing crime. But it was also decided—
And they also were closing means of employment that were close to neighborhoods. I know in New York City, if you grew up in certain poor neighborhoods, you could take a bus or you could even walk to your job no longer.
Yes. I mean, these were shifts that were occurring nationally and globally, but they were also occurring as a move of industrial, less skilled, but well-paying jobs out of the inner cities into the suburbs or beyond. So it was increasingly problematic for less educated workers to get good jobs in inner cities.
But that doesn't mean that they'll automatically turn to crime.
No, but for these individuals, we sort of characterize as kind of marginal offenders. These are individuals that are straddling sort of legal and illegal labor markets. And as opportunities shift away from formal legal employment, they will, in fact, move into illegal activities. And at the same time, we started to see increases in the drug trade. And so that became a source of employment, a source of earnings.
What role does determinate sentencing play in all of this?
Well, that's one part of a political shift that was also occurring at the same time, kind of more conservative political movement that adopted harsher criminal justice policies. And determinate sentencing was one element of that, mandatory minimum sentencing, a variety of sentencing policies that were all part of this tougher, get tough regime.
Isn't Mayor Bloomberg's proposed gun law an example of determinate sentencing?
Well, determinate sentencing is usually sort of thought of as a set of guidelines that restrict judicial discretion in meting out sentences. So it really depends whether they're just imposing mandatory minimums or whether they're actually specifying for a particular type of crime or type of offender a range of prison sentences.
Hasn't the role of the parole system changed since the late 70s?
Absolutely. Yeah. Michael, do you want to talk about—
Yeah, I mean, since the 1970s, the role of parole has definitely changed. As a result of mandatory minimums sentencing, fewer people, one, are going on parole. That's the first observation. The second is when they do, that parole enforcement has been much more strict. The things that we characterize as violating parole has become much more strict, and so there's been much more parole violations and many more people returning to prison as a result of these, in some cases, minor parole violations. So a lot of the recidivism that we've seen in the last 10 or 20 years has been chiefly from parole violations and not necessarily from new crimes and new arrests.
And that's where back-end sentencing comes into this?
Yeah, that's the idea. Back-end sentencing is essentially discretionary sentencing by parole officers. And just to be fair to them, I mean, they are facing increasing caseloads. As incarceration has increased, you know, the number going in sort of matches the number going out. And so with parole officers facing increasing caseloads, being strained by their resources, they are likely to reincarcerate somebody who violates maybe even minor technical conditions of parole just because they don't want them to, or they feel that they're going to actually maybe offend more seriously beyond that.
But the word parole is a dirty word in many people's minds. Every time a serious crime like the recent killings in Connecticut is committed by someone on parole, there's a public outcry, and people say the system isn't working.
Yeah, but the reality is, and this is, again, since the mid-90s, and this was a law passed under the Clinton administration, truth in sentencing, most offenders really, they really do serve the majority of the sentence that they're
right.
given. So this is, so 85% is usually a standard that most states have to abide by.
But hasn't overcrowding led to the paroling of some people who might not have gotten it otherwise?
That does happen. I mean, there are certainly cases where there's releases.
Sometimes the courts say,
yes.
you know, you just got to empty out some of your
right,
prisons.
Right. But the article today was indicating that, in fact, what's happening is states are actually exporting their prisoners to other locations. And that creates its own problems, especially for those being released, because when you increase the distance between where you're sent, where you're imprisoned and your community, then you really fragment the ties between prisoners and their families.
I'm speaking with David Wyman and Michael Stoll, two of the editors of a book called Barriers to Reentry, The Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America, published by the Russell Sage Foundation. And I misspoke about the Russell Sage Foundation. It's a rather august organization.
Yes.
How long has it been around?
It actually just celebrated its 100th anniversary.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I actually was coordinator of a working group on mass incarceration.
Mm-hmm. So you were working with the Russell Sage. Now, what is the Russell Sage Foundation's ultimate goal?
Well, this grew out of a program that was really interested in the labor market prospects of less skilled workers in the new labor market. So this post-industrial labor market was intended to connote the changing conditions of employment, especially for less skilled workers. And we found that a lot of those less skilled workers were engaged in criminal activity and actually finding themselves in prison because of the harsher criminal justice system.
Right. I think the general background is that the Russell Sage Foundation was built to improve social economic conditions generally, and has become the oldest foundation that has funded social science research and probably the most prominent research foundation.
What is the typical demographic of ex-convicts? How old do they tend to be, or do they cover the full range?
About 90% are men, although a growing percentage are women. A disproportionate share are African American, and they tend to range in age between 25 and 34, those who are released from prison.
So when they come out of prison, it's for a long time we've heard that it's difficult for them to get jobs. People in the old movies from the 30s, Jimmy Cagney wanted to go straight, and the guy would say, you were in Angola or whatever, and he's not getting that job. Have things gotten worse today?
Michael, you want to talk on that?
Yeah, have things gotten worse today? Well, I think.
Well, what barriers do people who've gotten out of prison typically face if they want to reenter society as productive participants?
Yeah, I think you can make a case that things have gotten worse on two dimensions. First, there's just many more ex-offenders than there's ever been because of the rise in the number of people that we've incarcerated. And second, there are a whole set of issues that are relevant to employers today that not necessarily relevant 10 or 20 years ago. Some of the chief barriers that ex-offenders face are, of course, employer resistance to hire them. And the reason why employers resist hiring them and prefer ex-offenders to lease to any other group is because of, one, state laws that restrict ex-offenders into certain kinds of occupations or jobs. And I think more importantly, outside of these statutes, is that employers fear legal liability for the actions of their employers. So increasingly, employers are not hiring ex-offenders because of fear of what we call negligent hiring lawsuits. And that is, if an employer hires an ex-offender and didn't do due diligence of doing a background check, and that employee who's an ex-offender harms a customer or even another employee, the employer can actually be held legally liable for those actions. So this is clearly the case in the health industry where there's been a case when an employer has hired an ex-offender and they have harmed someone that they've worked with at a home care institution.
So what kinds of jobs are they restricted too.
Well, that's again, this is an important result that actually Michael and some colleagues have found from an analysis of employer surveys. They find that the kinds of employers that are willing to hire ex-offenders, such as the construction trade, manufacturing, these are the type of employments. A lot of them have moved out of the city, especially manufacturing and wholesale distribution facilities, warehouses. So in that sense, and at the same time, prisoners tend to come from inner-city urban communities. So there's what we call a spatial mismatch. You have a concentration of ex-offenders in inner-city communities, but increasingly the kinds of jobs for which they would normally have access are really located pretty much at a distance with not really feasible mass transportation to get there.
Haven't some actually claimed in the past that prison lifestyle is an improvement over what they had in their old neighborhoods?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, when people talk about what we call incapacitation effects, that when we imprison people, they are not able to commit crimes. But the reality is there's a lot of criminal activity going on in prisons. We just don't count it. So I'm not sure that it's really safer in the sense that that they don't face a lot of the risks that they do on the streets. And in fact, because of the increasing prevalence of incarceration in inner city communities, there's really the barrier between prison and the community is beginning to dissolve, so that the same kinds of social contacts and relationships in the prison are now spilling over into the community and vice versa.
When these prisoners from poor neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, get released back into the world, what do they typically do first?
Well, it depends if whether they're released into parole or not. If they're not, there's very little policy or programs to ease the shift. Those that do have policies and programs are first tried to get assisted housing and jobs, and this is what parole typically has been involved with. Outside of parole, especially in California, for example, they're given $20 or $50 and put on a corner street, and they're left to their own devices. And without housing and a job, we know that within 30 to 60 days, those prisoners who are left on the street are likely to recidivate. So in most cases, they're left to their own devices.
Right, or their families and friends. I mean, our survey evidence from a pretty large study done by the Urban Institute shows that familial and, to some extent, friendship connections are really key for large numbers of released prisoners.
But with recidivism, then three strikes laws really can affect a life.
Right.
If you're left on a street corner with $20 and out of desperation, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, you commit a petty crime, you steal.
Right.
Didn't a guy go to jail for life because he stole a sandwich or something?
Yeah, we have things like that. But, you know, people should know New York has a version of this. It's called the predicate felony laws, in which, you know, if you commit a second felony offense, again, you kick in very steep minimum sentences. So there are various two-strike, three-strike laws in many different states.
But it's also true, isn't it, that most people who go to prison actually learn how to commit greater crimes than they were sent for? So the prisons are schools for crime as well. It must be very hard to avoid going back to a life of crime after you've spent so much time with people who've given you all sorts of inside information on how not to get caught next time.
Well, again, that's a concern because with the growth in prisons and the resources being devoted just to warehouse the prisoners, other types of programs that could utilize prisoners, whether it's an education or vocational training, that is, you know, there's a lot of idle time, and that idle time, you know, as we say, is the devil's handmaiden. So, yes, I mean.
But what's also important is that in one of the chapters in which authors had interviewed ex-prisoners who were coming out of prison, I mean, all of them said that they were motivated to find work. All of them wanted to abide by the law. All of them wanted to make good.
Right.
The question was whether the mechanisms and the resources to place in place to make that happen.
Yeah.
And for a lot of these men, although they were motivated to find work and some had skills and some didn't, a smaller share of them still got jobs over a 30 to 60 day window.
Yeah.
So even with motivation there and some skills, it's still very difficult for them to realize integration. Successful integration into society.
And just again to reinforce the point, we find that if there are programs, vocational training with work release programs, they're very successful bridges. They both occupy prisoners while they're in prison, and they are also transitions into the formal labor market.
And we'll come back to education after we take a little break. My guests are David F. Wyman, Elena Wells Hirshhorn, 58, professor of economics at Barnard College at Columbia University, and Michael R. Stoll, professor of public policy at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, along with Sean Bushway, I guess, who's at the University of at SUNY in Albany, have edited a book called Barriers to Reentry with a question mark, The Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America. It's published by the Russell Sage Foundation. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Michael A. Stoll and David F. Wyman, two of the editors of a book called Barriers to Reentry, The Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America, published by Russell Sage Foundation. Before we get to some of the programs that are out there, the positive and the negative ones, what about education? Isn't that a way for some of the ex-cons to turn around their lives? How difficult is it for them to get into some kind of an educational situation?
Two things. I mean, first, the modal education of most prisoners is quite low. And an Ohio study that's reported in the book, I mean, they came in with test scores that put them at the seventh grade, reading literacy levels. So clearly a lot of these individuals are certainly in need of education. But one problem is that eligibility oftentimes demands that you're in prison for a long enough period of time to complete a program. And, many individuals are there for just a year or, within a very short spells. So on the one hand, there are those formal requirements. And at the same time, again, what's happened is just the sheer increase in the numbers relative to the resources being devoted to educational programs.
But we're also very confused about what this education ultimately means. We've had any number of cases of people who have really turned their lives around, edited the prison newspaper, written books.
Right.
And except in a few cases, when they've been released from prison, they have lived solid lives. There was the Jack Abbott debacle, which many people will bring up every time this is ever discussed. But there's always an argument over whether people should pay for the crime, even if they have turned around their lives.
Yeah.
How do we balance the punishment? Somebody's killed somebody, and we've said put them away for life, with the idea that they actually have educated themselves and become worthwhile citizens.
That's a tough one. When we're talking in the book, our focus tends to be on nonviolent, oftentimes victimless crimes and offenders. But if you actually look internationally, you find that, in other countries, murder doesn't get a sentence of life in prison. And in fact, over time, most individuals do desist. That is, they do cease in their criminal activity.
They get older and they're less likely
to
be violent.
That's right.
Right. And oftentimes, murder itself is really an impulsive act, which would not be one that would be repeated. So again, by locking people up like that for long periods of time, you're really just condemning them to a life in prison.
And we should also note that that represents a very small fraction of those who are incarcerated.
Right.
The majority are incarcerated for nonviolent victimless crimes.
Yeah. Mostly drugs, as you point out.
Drugs and property. I also was noticing in the statistics, there's also public order. I mean, in the olden days, these were called moral crimes or moral offenses, and they've seen a real surge in the percentage of prisoners for these moral crimes, public order and drug crimes.
Is a white ex-con with no college education more likely to get a job when he gets out of prison than a black ex-con?
There is a study in our book that suggests and indicates that that is true, but it comes with some caveats. It is true in industries which are probably very sensitive to whether or not they are going to hire an ex-convict, and that would be in industries in which there's greater customer contact, like in the restaurant industry and the service industry. In those kind of industries, yes, some research that one of our authors in the book conducted of employers and of matched pairs of ex-offenders, one of whom was white and one of whom was black, and matched pairs of non-offenders, one of whom was black and one of whom was white, and with all the same skill sets, did suggest that it was much easier for a white convict to get a job than a black convict.
If I could just make a plug for that research, this was done by Diva Pager at Princeton and Bruce Western, who's now going to be at Harvard. But they did a study of New York, and so I think that your listeners might be interested in sort of, if you go to Diva Pager's website, she's in the sociology department at Princeton, she does have a link to her study of the New York case, which is very similar, that in fact African-American, Hispanic ex-prisoners have a much more difficult time than white.
Were unions a way for ex-cons to get back into general society in the past? Unions have a lot less clout these days. Have they also changed their attitudes about people who've come out of prison?
That's a good question. Mike, I'm drawing a blank on this one.
I'm drawing a blank, too.
Okay, well.
I'm not sure of the role of unions in reintegration to the labor market.
Right.
But you point out that drug felons are denied many welfare services, including federal grants for higher education,
and that
becomes a big problem. That
was and public housing.
So how can somebody who'd been arrested for drugs ever get out of the rut?
It's really a problem. I mean, there was a very effective community college programs in prisons that were being funded in part through these Pell Grants. And then when the money dried up, those programs actually also dried up, although there's some effort to reinstate them. And yes, it's true. I mean, they were actually quite successful programs providing relevant job skills that would really ease the transition into the labor market. But the trouble is when you have people in prison, there's this really a kind of punitive impulse that says they must pay for their crime, and therefore there's a reluctance to offer them services that, for example, people outside of prison don't have.
Right, and I think there's a lot of other work besides our volume that had talked about some of the overreaching by states in this regard, because as you know, for someone that has a drug felony conviction, in most states you're denied, in all states you're denied access to federal financial aid for higher education, you're denied public housing assistance, and you're denied welfare assistance as well. So all the potential social policy bridges that could help integrate ex-offenders into society are not available to them, and it makes it much more difficult for them to navigate once they get out of prison.
Go ahead.
I just say it really raises the question what it means to pay for your crime, because on the one hand, paying for your crime may mean just, or used to mean just maybe going to prison. It could be actually even paying a fine or even community service. But now what we've done is we've attached a whole slew of what some have called invisible punishments, all of these different restrictions that make it increasingly difficult. I mean, even just, you know, the disenfranchisement of felons in many states is another form of this sort of invisible punishment.
My guests are David F. Wyman and Michael A. Stoll, two of the editors of a book called Barriers to Reentry, The Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America, from the Russell Sage Foundation. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why has the war on drugs been referred to as a moral panic? Hasn't the crack epidemic pretty much died down?
Yeah, we called it a moral panic just because it does appear, and this is, again, it's not our terminology. We were drawing on a lot of literature. It appears as an overreaction to what was really a very horrific episode during the late 1980s and early 1990s surrounding the crack trade. There's a tremendous surge in lethal violence, gun violence, and this sort of helped to congeal this kind of get-tough attitude. But there was a lot of misinformation circulating around crack that led to the enactment of very harsh punishments. I mean, the most notorious is the, you know, inequality in sentencing between crack versus powder cocaine.
And we've talked a lot about getting tough on crime. Has the situation eased at all? Are there people out there, district attorneys and the like, who are trying to come up with new solutions because the old ones aren't working?
Well, there are. I mean, I just wanted to make reference to a couple of programs that are prevalent in New York. And Charles Hines in Brooklyn has been really sort of a pioneer in diffusing some of them. And one of the drug courts, these are typically for less serious drug offenders. And the other is a program called DTAP, which is an alternative to prison, so drug treatment alternative to prison. So these programs, typically they essentially sentence individuals to the drug court, or they sentence them to this residential treatment program, provide them with a variety of psychological employment services plus drug treatment. And then after a year and a half or two in the DTAP program, what's interesting is that their felony conviction is actually erased, so they no longer carry that stigma. But they also possess a lot of the psychological, emotional, and viable vocational skills to re-enter successfully into the labor market, into their communities. And recidivism rates have for these groups are actually quite low relative to a kind of comparable population that went to prison. So there are alternatives, which it would be nice if they could be diffused as really the default option for a lot of drug offenders.
Right. This is very similar in California, where we have a Proposition 36, which voters enacted about 2 years ago, that gave people convicted of drug offenses the option to go into drug court. And in some senses, it's mandatory that offenders participate in these kinds of programs.
What about the private therapeutic groups like Odyssey House? Are they can they handle all the people who have a problem, or and are they necessarily always a positive thing? Synanon turned into a terrible cult at one point.
Well, the DTAP program, what I know about it, does work with a large number of groups, you know, community groups and treatment facilities. So again, it's a question about the resources and the certification of the programs. I mean, but the issue is that this is actually also a cost-effective mechanism.
Right.
But it would require a reallocation of our resources. So instead of building more prisons to accommodate the overcrowding problem, which the Times highlighted today, you know, we might more fruitfully invest our resources in drug rehabilitation and vocational training program, that kind of complex of programming that would actually assist offenders so that they won't recidivate in the future.
Many policymakers in the 70s and 80s attributed higher arrest rates to the rise of illegal drugs, but also the gangs that were associated with those drugs. What's happened with those gangs? Haven't they turned into businesses? Has mass incarceration at such high levels and such high levels of recidivism actually strengthened the gangs?
Yeah.
The gangs of Los Angeles are famous.
Yeah.
Michael, what's happening with them?
Well, it's hard to say that mass incarceration was a causal factor in the either reinforcement or growth of these kinds of quote-unquote gang businesses. Many of the gangs started getting involved in the drug trade well before many of these sentences were enacted. And it's not clear to me whether or not if we didn't impose these kind of changes in sentencing that led to a growth in imprisonment, that would have led to increased strengthening or growth of these kind of gangs.
But the gangs continue inside the prisons.
They do, and there's recruitment. I mean, so that gangs do recruit new members in the prison, and in some cases the prison becomes a safe haven for gang members to negotiate and discuss without a fear of conflict. So,
but this could be adaptation. I mean, these are just increased barriers to what is a market force. And it's the adaptation of this market into the prison. So it's not clear to me that the prisons are driving this. I mean, there is a market for this, and whether or not the prisons were a causal factor is, I think, is the question.
Yeah. The irony, though, is that the prison doesn't seem to be dissolving the gang strength.
Exactly.
So it's not helping the problem. It may not be reinforcing it.
Right.
Some people have suggested that there's a connection between the end of the civil rights era and the trend toward mass incarceration of young men, most of them black.
Yeah, well, there is a pretty striking correlation between a shift to more conservative politics and the punitive criminal justice policies. And you see this in the rhetoric that really goes back to the 1950s, where conservative Democrats and Republicans were characterizing civil rights legislation and movement for equality as they called it, criminogenic. They felt the mixing of the races is how they would characterize it would actually result in more crime. And then when you start to see civil rights protests, civil disobedience, or the riots that spread in the 60s, this was all viewed as sort of evidence of criminal activity associated with criminal justice and did help fuel this law and order, you know, war on crime and eventually war on drug campaign. So there is a continuity politically between the criticism of civil rights movements and legislation and the, you know, the get tough on crime movement that occurs in the later 70s and 80s.
So except for what we've been seeing in some of these drug courts around the country, do you see any positive signs?
Well, you know, there is, and again, in the last chapter of the book, Bruce Western does talk about some of the positive rehabilitation programs, vocational programs. I mean, the point that Bruce and some of our other studies really demonstrate is that these can make a marginal impact. But the problem is really massive. That's this terminology, mass incarceration. Really, you know, we think about that estimates suggest that one-third of African-American males will experience prison in their lifetime. And that's just for the entire population. If you just look at less educated African-American males, it could be upwards to 50%. So this is a massive problem in these communities, and these programs can have marginal effects. So we really need to think of something bolder that's going to really break the cycle.
When we read statistics like that, we tend to think of serious crimes, but this can be anything from the most just being picked up on a driving because you were driving erratically, or maybe because a cop, as some people have said, driving while being black.
Yes.
That adds to the statistics?
Yes. Well, you know, we see in the data on arrests, I mean, again, we focused on the drug arena, but African-American men are arrested disproportionately, at least relative to the use of drugs in the African-American and white communities.
Right.
They're convicted disproportionately relative to their arrest rates. They're incarcerated at greater numbers relative to their – I mean, so at every step of the way, at least in terms of drug crimes, there does seem to be this strong racial bias.
And crack is punished a lot more punitively
yes.
than cocaine
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one of the – probably one of the reasons why, too, at right. least at the conviction and the incarceration
absolutely. Yeah.
level, is because of the disproportionate enforcement of crack relative to powder cocaine and sentencing.
Yeah.
The crack sentence is about five times as stringent as a powder yeah. cocaine sentence for the equivalent amount of substance.
Yeah. But the striking thing, again, I just came across these data for New York State. 80 to 90% of all drug arrests in New York State are located in New York City. And no one's going to tell me that 80% of all the drug crime, right, is concentrated in the city. And so, again, that really does lead you to question what's really going on. And it's not just at the sentencing level. It's really also, as you suggest, the way the police are actually being mobilized and also the prosecutor's offices in terms of prosecuting these crimes.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. David F. Wyman is Elena Wells Hirshhorn, 58th Professor of Economics at Barnard College, Columbia University. Michael R. Stoll is Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Los Angeles. They are two of the editors of a book called Barriers to Reentry, The Labor Market for Released Prisoners in Post-Industrial America, published by Russell Sage Foundation. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. ¶¶